The Road to Maine's Digital Future. Like it or not, the digital world is evolving at a breathtaking pace. Where is Maine in the transition? I'm Keith Shortall, and today we explore the advancements we've made as a state that have helped us to prepare for the digital world in education, history, culture, and science. With me in the studio, Steve Bromage, Executive Director of the Maine Historical Society, Linda Lord, Director of the Maine State Library, and Betty Manchester, President of the Maine International Center for Digital Learning. And as always, we'd like to hear from you. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, post to our Facebook page, or give us a call. 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. The digital future. This is Maine Calling.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN radio listener contributions and by Packard Judd Kay, providing strategic marketing consulting, communications, research, and training services online at PackardJuddKay.com.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today, as I just mentioned, we're talking about the digital future. But what does digital even mean? We're not talking about our fingers here. We're talking about zeros and ones. But is digital a medium? Is it a word that describes this whole new world? What exactly is it? We'll start the conversation today with that question. And Betty Manchester, I'll go to you first. When we're talking about things digital, what are we talking about?
Well, at this point, there's a lot more digital than there ever was. I would say that it's anything that is offered to anyone from a distance in terms of internet, in terms of social media, and anything that requires you to go on to a device of a sort to use the medium that's available to you anytime, anywhere.
Steve Bromage, is that kind of how you see it as well?
Yeah, when I think digital, I think I tend to really think in terms of access and participation. And it's just digital to me represents a set of tools that it gives us to kind of do our work in new and different ways and to connect in different ways. So to me, access and participation.
And Linda Lord at the Maine State Library.
What we're very concerned about right now is digital literacy, which is people having the skills and having the knowledge of the various tools in order to fit into today's digital society and lead the best lives they can in this society.
And in some ways, we have a generational split, not to paint too broad a brush to it, but there are some, particularly younger people, who are comfortable swimming in this world. There are older folks who never saw it and sort of shun it and don't want to have anything to do with it, some of them. There are people like me who kind of came of age in the middle. I've touched both worlds, and I still struggle, but I know enough to get by. Is there a danger that we are divided as haves and have-nots in terms of our age and our cultural status?
I think not in Maine as much as other places. I think what is important is that we learn to work together and with the tools. For instance, digital literacy. What does literacy mean? And that's the kind of teaching that needs to go on to make sure that people know how to use the tools.
Is there, Steve Bromage, are there sort of two groups, those who embrace it and those who don't? And can we still talk to each other?
You know, I think it's interesting. Again, I mentioned connections. I think what we're finding in our work is that doing digital projects gives an opportunity for people to connect. So the previous generation you refer to has a whole set of knowledge and information and skills, as do young people. And when you put them together on a project, in our case, it's around digitizing historical collections, they get to share that and they come together. So I really see the digital and the analog as complementary and really working to reinforce each other as opposed to being mutually exclusive.
Any thoughts?
That's a very interesting question. Because what we're finding in the library world is that the divide isn't necessarily between senior citizens, one of which I am, and young people in their teens and 20s, but even 30-year-olds and 15-year-olds are using digital tools and attached to their devices in a very different way. So it's a rapidly moving landscape.
And as we look back at how this first began, my recollection of, you know, the first time that I went to a website, it was all sort of storage of stuff. You could find it and see it, but there wasn't a great deal of interactivity, Betty Manchester, at least at first. It was all sort of a storage place.
That's right. And in the beginning, everything was you had to find things, and that was the important goal, was finding. Now it's changed to collaborating and working to use all the tools in different ways. And it's much more a medium where you would use things for talking, for acting, for developing, for moving and communicating with people across the world.
So let's talk about some of the initiatives. We've mentioned a few of them, hinted at them. Steve, let's start with you, and let's talk about this project that sort of captures not only oral histories, but all sorts of historical information, and I guess curates it for people who want to be able to find it and interact with it.
Sure. Well, the project you're talking about is the Maine Memory Network, and it was created by Maine Historical Society and launched in 2001. And the real original idea around it was about access. You know, there's more than 225 local historical societies in Maine, all who have tremendous collections, but for the most part, those collections weren't accessible. Same goes with us. We have got a tremendous collection in our institution in Portland. So when we created it, we wanted to, A, let people see it. That's something that had always been a challenge for us. What was neat about Maine Memory, when we created it, we could do it in a way that would let actually any local historical society or collecting organization scan material locally in their collection and contribute it to this central database.
So what sort of material are we talking about?
Primarily historical objects and artifacts, so lots and lots of historical photographs, letters, and diaries. We now have 270 or so organizations around the state who are contributing. They've all been trained. They all have material online in Maine Memory Network. And they select the material that they want to put online. So that's one of the neat dynamics.
And what is, the end vision of it? Is it to interest kids in Maine history, to interest everyone in Maine history, to what would you say is the goal?
Well, I think that evolves. I think it's really about engagement and connecting people to Maine history, to their communities. And it's even our work and our the things we've been focused on has evolved. Maine Memory really started as a digital archive, so it was just about access to items. And that continued to grow, and it became an online museum, which was about putting interpretive material together and letting communities and partners tell stories about their place or the topics they were interested in. And now in its latest phase, it's really been kind of about community mobilization. So the process of getting material online has helped organizations across communities come together, collaborate to look at their history, and then work together to figure out how to tell their story and to put it online. So it continues to move and evolve. And while we've been around for 10 years, I really see Maine Memories in its infancy, and it's going to continue to evolve as the whole digital culture does.
What would you say is the – I don't know, if you had your wish, what obstacle would you like to overcome to grow it or see it through? Is it all about money?
That's a great question. It is in part about money. It's about time. It's about the ability to reach people. I think a lot of people are interested and want to participate, and it takes time to do it and to do it well. So time is an issue. Again, I think we are in our infancy, and there's still a lot of people around Maine who don't know about Maine Memory Network. So I think for us, building awareness, there's incredibly deep and broad resources. There's a lot of opportunity that's represented in it. The participation can help develop skills and build community in a lot of ways. So for us at this point, really building attention and awareness and use. And then one of the nice dynamics is it feeds and energizes itself because local projects happen and contribute new material. So it's contribution and creation of content is really dispersed.
Linda Lord, the Maine School and Library Network is another one of these projects that we're talking about. What is it and why is it so important to you?
Thank you. The Maine School and Library Network provides internet connectivity to every school and public library in Maine, we were the first state in the country to have every school building and every library that wanted to be connected to the internet without this broad reach of accessibility across the state. There would be no Maine Memory Network. A lot of the services provided by today's libraries would not exist, and the laptop program would not have been able to be ubiquitous. So thanks to the vision of the Public Utilities Commission back in 1995, we were able to come up with the Maine School Library Network. And when I say we, I'm talking specifically the Maine State Library and the Department of Education were ordered by the PUC to figure out how to provide rates, services, or equipment to all Maine schools and libraries. And the Maine School Library Network was the result of that collaborative work.
And so is that network, is that a physical infrastructure? Is it literally wires connecting?
it literally is a physical network, but a lot of wireless involved at this point too. Most of our public libraries do offer wireless connectivity.
I'm wondering, traditionally, of course, in my town, the Thomaston Public Library was a place that you usually, because you didn't have your own set of encyclopedias at home yet, because you'd only collected half of them. So you went there to do your reports and to take out books to read. And the library is still that, but it's with this sort of introduction of this network and access to the internet and to other things, it's really libraries' missions have changed.
Ooh, greatly. When I first heard this a couple of years ago, I was shocked by it, but I quickly learned that it's absolutely accurate. It used to be that our public libraries brought the world into the towns where they were located. And now, one of the reasons that we collaborate with Maine Historical Society on the Maine Memory Network and the grants that the Maine Memory Network has done so well receiving from the federal government, we are providing what is now called maker spaces in order to bring our communities to the world. Because no one else can provide information on Thomaston's history and Thomaston's artifacts except the people in the town of Thomaston.
True enough. Betty Manchester, you were the first director of what is known as the Maine Learning Technology Initiative.
Yes.
Better known as the
Laptop Project.
Sure. It's been a few years since that was first introduced. It was a bold and new idea. How would you describe its status now? What does it mean to us now?
Well, in the beginning, we were not sure how things were going to go. This was 10 years ago, and we foresaw that everything was going to be using technology, and that would be a valuable part of the use of technology would be in the next 10 years, but we didn't know what or how. So we really found that it was important in that time to begin to develop our program in such a way that every town was touched by the laptop project. So it was important that every school in the community have the laptop program and that that would grow with the students. So it was the first time Maine had ever given tools to every teacher in Maine, starting with the middle school, and our hope was that it would go on to the high school.
Is Maine viewed as in the vanguard of that?
Oh, yes. In fact, we have people from all over the world that visit us on a regular basis, stay in touch with us in terms of the work we're doing.
You have since you're now co-founder and president of the Maine International Digital Learning Center. Sorry, what is that? Briefly?
Angus King and I started the program, and it was as a liftoff from the Maine Learning Technology Program, in that we wanted to make a more formal connection to other places in the world and countries. So it was that we had lots of visitors come, but we also wanted to learn from everyone who came to visit us. So we've connected with researchers and projects around the world.
Interesting. We're going to take a short break. Join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. When we come back, we'll go to the phones And we'll go to Daniel in Cooper, who is waiting patiently. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
After the Sandy Hook school shooting, President Obama gave Joe Biden a month to come up with concrete proposals to cut down on gun violence. Tomorrow, the president unveils his proposals. I'm Celeste Headlee. From executive actions to new bills in Congress, the president's plan on guns and violence. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And that was recorded yesterday, so the president has unveiled his plan, and we will hear more about it on Talk of the Nation from 2 till 4 p.m. this afternoon.
Recently on The Takeaway, we heard this suggestion on having more guns in schools, not less.
I think they should allow teachers to carry on the job in their school system, in their classroom.
That suggestion came from a former Texas legislator. But what are teachers being taught about firearms in this era of school shootings? That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Join us for The Takeaway this evening at midnight.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Maine's digital past, present, and future. With me in the studio, Steve Bromage, Executive Director of the Maine Historical Society. Betty Manchester, she was the Maine Learning Technology Initiative first Director of Special Projects. Today serves as President of the Maine International Center for Digital Learning. And Linda Lord, Maine State Librarian. We'd like you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. As promised, we'll go now to the phones to Cooper and Daniel. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hi there. First of all, I'm going to comment that I think this is a great show. I think this is a very good, timely subject for the state of Maine. But I'm going to pose a question to the panel. If they're aware of the inadequate broadband situation in the entire state of Maine and how the direction to support all of these initiatives that you are working so hard at, the direction for the state of Maine, that the state of Maine is taking, specifically the Connect Me Authority, is advancing DSL, fixed wireless, and cable networks. I've been in the technology business for 30 years, and those three technologies they're antiquated at this point, and DSL in particular is being dumped across the country. And in Maine, we're expanding it. And one piece that really jumps out at me is the laptop project, which I think is wonderful. And I met with Senator King here back in April and spoke with him at length about that one. And that is a great project, but it falls very, very short in that when these students are at schools that are connected, but they go home, and a vast majority of the students in Maine either have no connections to the internet or they have very, very minimal connections. So going forward, knowing that video traffic is going to be increasing, you know, exponentially, more and more people are getting online, the networks are going to be overcrowded, and these systems, the DSL fixed cable, wireless and cable, will not match the network needs.
Well, let's bring in our group. Linda, you've been nodding your head on a few of these points. Do you want to start?
I agree with everything that the gentleman just said. I serve on the Connect Me Advisory Board, which reports to the Connect Me Authority, and this is a tremendous concern on all fronts. I personally live in the middle of Waldo County. I have DSL service at home. I can't imagine when the day will come that I can have faster speed at home.
Could you just explain what DSL is as compared to, you know,
slow.
As a technology, though, what is DSL as different from, you know, Time Warner or dial-up?
I think probably the gentleman on the phone can do a better job of explaining that than I can. But I can say that when the main
to try to explain that.
Sure, please.
DSL is it stands for Digital Subscriber Line. It's a method of getting high-speed internet, relative high-speed internet, across standard copper lines. That's why it's so prolific, because we all have phone lines in our homes. The problem with DSL is it's what referred to as asymmetrical. That's one speed, a high speed down and a very, very low speed up. Cable is done with coax. Similar technology, only under cable, you can bring much faster speeds down, but you're still restricted with going up. And the way the internet is designed now across the world is fiber-based networks are what are being built everywhere else except this country.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that. That does help give us a primer on what we're talking about. So, Linda, you said this is a concern. Is it a policy issue that we're or is it?
It's money.
Yeah.
It truly is. The Connect Me Authority is able to give grants to towns and service providers who team up and apply for areas that are not served or, in my case, that are underserved. So it takes some work and interest in the realization of the need on the part of local people. But then there is some recourse there, although the money is not endless.
Now, we've heard about the three-ring binder, yes, and that major project, which was, I believe, completed late last year.
Yeah.
In 2012. And Daniel, is that not a big step forward in connecting citizens of Maine together if it continues?
What's happened with Three Ring Binder? Well, Three Ring Binder is a good concept. It's a fiber-based network, which all the networks need to be. What it hasn't addressed is the last mile, which is to the homes. What it's basically done throughout Maine across the three rings is it's allowed additional providers to provide a service where it already existed along the Route 1 corridor, where we already had Time Warner, already had Fairpoint. If you were to come to an area like Cooper or many other areas in Maine, there's no laterals. There's nothing coming off of Three Ring. And the premise was that Three Ring was going to open it up and all these competitors are going to come rushing to the area to provide the networks to the areas that don't have it. But what's happened is even the competitors that are now here, we have an additional competitor in this area now that comes up Three Ring. But they're not going to provide any of these laterals. They're not going to go any further until they can basically take away the customer base from the existing telecoms, which will build them a network structure and an income stream. Then they're you know, promising to branch out, which will never happen. I mean, at the rate we're going, Maine is stepping backwards. We're really, by not investing in the Connect Me thing in particular, to me, I don't understand why the advisory board isn't directing all of the money that they've got towards whatever fiber laterals they can run, not DSL and not coax, but fiber laterals. That will bring this economy in complete circles.
All right, we'll give Linda one last word, and then we appreciate your call, Daniel. Thanks for calling in.
Well, he mentioned specifically the advisory committee, and that's exactly what the advisory committee is. It's advisory, and the Connect Maine Authority sets policy and oversees the spending priorities. I really appreciate hearing the gentleman's comments, and I can identify with a lot of what he says. From the point of view of libraries, the three-ring binder has been helpful because it's been close enough to some public libraries to supply fiber direct to the wall for them. But obviously, he's right. We have a long way to go.
Yeah. Betty?
Well, I was going to say that these problems can be worked on, and they can be overcome with people collaborating and figuring out what is the best way to proceed. We had similar problems 10 years ago when we started because things were not connected, and there were various ways in which we collaborated to make it possible for schools and homes to be connected. So I have great faith in the people of Maine to problem solve this out.
1-800-399-3566, the number to join the conversation. Steve Bromage?
Yeah, I think the broader issue here is, you know, that we have to realize that we have to continue to invest in this infrastructure.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that brings us together today is that Maine has been way ahead of the nation and ahead of the curve on a lot of these issues and making these investments and seeing what the impact can be. But the rest of the world is going to catch up with us, and we're going to have to continue to evolve and develop the infrastructure for it to grow and to be of use. Just a little piece of historical context, because I guess that's what I do. But we currently have an exhibit up that looks at the electrification of Maine over the course of the 20th century, and it grows out of our Central Maine Power Collection, which is really incredible. But it demonstrates this investment in infrastructure and technology over time. And when electricity first came here, people didn't know what the impact was going to be. They didn't know the opportunities it was going to create. So, you know, in the 1920s, CMP had stores to sell toasters and appliances and other things to get people to buy electricity. So, but I guess the point being that we just have to continue to invest in the infrastructure to make these things happen. And we don't know exactly where it's going to take us, but we know it's essential to our future.
We can talk more about infrastructure, but I also want to talk about how we use some of this equipment. Back when the laptop initiative emerged, it was all about the hardware and where the units were coming from and how many there would be and which grades would get them. And there wasn't a whole lot of focus on what they were going to do with them once they got them, because computers don't really teach kids anything. It's a tool. Do we know, for example, Betty, that having laptops in classrooms has helped kids learn language skills, math skills better than?
Yes, we do. In fact, from the beginning, there was a great focus on teaching and learning, and there was less focus in the circles of the schools around the tools and more focus on how do we use these for education. So there has been continued professional development for everyone in the education field. I think that there is evidence with science, there's evidence with math, there's evidence with reading that it makes a difference. I think what is difficult is that we as educators nationally and locally keep changing what we want teachers to do. And that is what makes it more difficult. But there is definitely a lot of evidence in terms of the growth that kids have made in using the technology tools.
I'm thinking back when I was in school and we had textbooks and they were in the closet stacked up and they were there for probably 10 years and you could tell and nothing really changed in the curriculum. We went through chapter 7 of Your World and Mine just like every previous class of the last, you know, decade.
Right.
Now it's different every year. There's a different program, a new one. It changes as fast as the technology itself.
Right.
It must be a huge sort of challenge for teachers.
Well, it is, but I think there's solutions to that. And a lot of it is the problem solving and the creativity and the license to collaborate with agencies such as Maine Memory to develop problems and programs locally that really give the kids great learning experiences. And that's where the focus needs to be. And the making use of the library resources that are much richer in this state than most states at this time. So I think that it's not to focus on the old, but look at what's new and what can be solved with collaboration, with creativity, problem solving. A good problem would be to give this problem to the kids in Maine to solve. Yes, and they are great at doing that sort of thing, and that's what is creating the need, the practice for the real world.
1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566 to Gorham and Andrew. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you so much. I love your show, by the way.
Thank you.
Yes. I just wanted to bring up a point. I was an educator over the years, and just friends and colleagues of mine have just kind of stated the frustration, even though the laptop program is a great program and it is important to bring a lot of world information to our children. The issue is, since teachers are under such a large amount of stress, the computers have kind of become the babysitter for writing skills and penmanship issues. And, you know, what's happened is a lot of kids are starting out at a young age and they're ending up in middle school and high school, and they can't write their name because they're constantly typing or using the computer to do homework. And I just wanted to kind of shoot that out there to you and kind of ask you, you know, what do you think could be done about that in terms of having the use and access to computers and information versus literacy, where you actually physically, you know, research a subject, you have to write it down, you have to do notes by literally physically using your hands and writing skills.
It is true that, I mean, I can't write as well anymore as I used to, and I'm not even a physician, but it's hard to, without practicing using a pen, and there are some skills that I guess we push to the back of our mind when we're on a computer all the time.
Yes. Well, if you look at President Obama's just going to appoint somebody to assist him, and everybody's been making a joke about his handwriting. So I think that is not a skill that people identify with, but they don't choose to get a job because they can write. I think there is a great deal of emphasis on literacy throughout the state, and that just has to continue. And that is teaching teachers how to teach with these new tools some of the skills that they know are important for kids to have. And there is lots of staff development available through the MLTI project. There is staff development available through the state in literacy. And the universities at the same time need to continue to work on those skills that we consider basics.
The notion here isn't simply plopping kids down and having them solve problems for 8 hours and then
right.
bringing them home. It's still you're interacting with other students and with the teacher. Again, it's a tool. I guess the caller's point is it can go too far in terms of crutching out on you know using that only.
Yes, and that's the role that you play in schools of evaluating teachers and looking at the way resources are used.
All right. 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Penobscot and Ken. Hi, Ken.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
I'd like to get some comments on what I see as a political-based situation. Where I live, I'm not served either by a telephone company or a cable company for internet. There is what I believe is a radio-based service where your home has to be more or less in a line of sight to a mountaintop. And it happens that my home isn't. It may be that some of my neighbors are. But I'm thinking that this private company that provides this service, I mean, they would essentially claim to serve my town when, in fact, I can't get service from them. And I believe they would object to, say, government grants going to maybe a new potential competitor that would like to bring service to my town through maybe the Connect Me program or something like that.
Sure. There is a conflict, a potential conflict of government subsidizing in a way that hurts private enterprise.
Exactly.
Well, if private enterprise learns that a grant is coming in from a company to serve people that are not being served, they have, in my mind, two choices. And this is very simplistic, but they can either step up and provide the service to you, or they can realize you don't have the service, somebody else can provide it, and that's the way it is.
All right, thank you for the call. Let's go to Portland and John. Hi, John.
Hi, I just want to paraphrase that I'm not a Luddite by any by any stretch of the imagination. And one of your guests said that there's been studies done that shows that there's been there's evidence that the policies of providing the computers and everything is paid off in across the board. But I disagree with that. And I wonder what cost-to-benefit ratio studies have ever been done, because every time I ever go to the library, I see people sitting there, including kids, sitting there playing games or surfing the webs or using social media. And, I wonder, is my tax dollars being used to subsidize Facebook access or game playing?
Who wants to Linda.
I am bursting at the use of computers in libraries, because although the gentleman is right, there certainly is that sort of thing going on. We are experiencing something in our public libraries I never thought I'd live to see. Many, many companies now will not accept job applications unless submitted online, and they will not even set up an interview unless the applicant has an email address that they can respond to. So there are also people in our library saying, I don't know how to find this application online. I don't have an email address. Can you help me? And that's what libraries are doing to help them. Another thing that we're doing that really supports all Mainers is cooperatively purchasing with a number of groups databases online, and database is just a word that means journal articles, newspapers, reference books that no individual school or library could ever afford in print, much less electronically, and making these available to schools, businesses, libraries, and even from the home all across Maine.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back and we'll talk more about this. It's okay, Linda. It's all right. Stay with us. 1-800-399-3566. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, with so many Americans scraping by, we'll look at debt traps and who's most vulnerable. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join us for On Point this evening at 11 p.m. If you have a smartphone, there are a couple of easy ways to take MPBN Radio along with you. For both Android and iPhones, there are two free smartphone apps which work well, the NPR News app and the TuneIn Radio app. Both allow you to easily find MPBN Radio and save it as a favorite. Find both the NPR News and TuneIn Radio app in the Android and iPhone app stores or marketplace. And again, they're free. Enjoy MPBN Radio wherever and whenever you'd like. Join us at 1 o'clock following Maine Calling for Alternative Radio. Today's topic, Islamophobia. The speaker is Deepa Kumar, Associate Professor of Media Studies and Middle East Studies at Rutgers University. She is also the author of Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire. That's Alternative Radio following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Preserving Maine's Memories, connecting us to the digital superhighway. With me in the studio, Steve Bromage, Executive Director of the Maine Historical Society. Betty Manchester, she was the Maine Learning Technology Initiative First Director of Special Projects. Today serves as President of the Maine International Center for Digital Learning. And Linda Lord, Maine's State Librarian. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, post to our Facebook page, or tweet at Maine Calling to Belfast. And Steve, hi, Steve.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. The reason I was calling is my son was in the first class of kids to get the middle school computers. And he fairly shortly after ran through the high school's math offerings, and he ended up his high school math career taking courses online from Johns Hopkins University. And the interesting thing was that they wanted all his assignments to be faxed back in, not emailed. They wanted them by fax. And we have a very slow, actually when he started to do it, he had a dial-up connection. Mm-hmm. And that didn't really hinder him watching the lectures. Sometimes the video wasn't very good, but it was pretty much audio. And, you know, what I noticed, he's now in college. He's a computer science major at McGill. And I asked him how much he uses bandwidth. And he said, oh, a day's assignment, it takes me about 1 second to transmit. In the meantime, in the next room, his buddies are playing World of Warcraft and are taking up all the bandwidth on Earth. And I think that's really kind of what's going on, is bandwidth gets used for video games, and the actual work with computers doesn't take much bandwidth at all.
Yeah. Any comments?
Well, in terms of libraries and bandwidth, we have 11 public libraries scattered from York to Holton, who have video conferencing capability, and that does take bandwidth. And there are classes being given over those video conferencing tools, and there are so many. The more people you have, of course, online at one time, you need broader bandwidth. And there are so many creative, wonderful, accessible things going on in Maine's public libraries that I'm never going to have time to share with you on this show. But if you go to the Maine State Library website, it will give you a clue of some of the very important learning opportunities that are being provided because of this bandwidth.
And we'll make sure we get all of your websites, too, before we go. Yeah.
I was going to say, in the schools, the bandwidth is monitored quite closely. And because the sharing of valuable information is really important. So it is important in the schools. They are very careful about watching what is how the bandwidth is used.
Let's go. Oh, sorry, Steve. Did you have something?
No, I was just going to say, you know, to the last caller's comment. You know, the world has gone digital, and it's affecting all aspects of our life, and it's entertainment, and it's education. It's things we're interested in and things we're not interested in. And I think, you know, it's to me, it's about the opportunities this is creating and the responsibilities and the opportunity we each have is nurturing how it's transforming each of our work. So, you know, this digital infrastructure and opportunity is changing the way people are, in our case, encountering history. They're participating in it and how it's being representative. So, you know, I just want to focus again on the opportunities this creates and to transform all the kinds of work we're doing.
I listen to MPBN at home on my computer, by the way. I don't have a radio. Let's go to Gary now. Hi, Gary. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Thank you for taking my call. And the reason I'm calling is about the digital divide is not only generational, but it's also geographic. As a last miler up here in the unorganized territories, we were first cut off when analog television went to digital. We don't have enough people to for a cable company to reach us. Our antennas can't reach any digital stations, so most people lost all of their connection with television unless they could afford a satellite. The same thing is true with our internet. I use the term loosely because today my dial-up connection, my only connection, is not working. My cell phone doesn't work in this area. And it's not only educational because we do try to bring distance learning to people. We're pretty far from any library, and our businesses are suffering. It's a beautiful part of the country, but people won't stay on our ends because we are unable to provide internet access. So I know the other callers have talked about the plight of the last milers, but is there any hope for us? So with the monopolies, we have one company, and they say maybe next year. We've stopped work for the winter, but maybe next year, and we've heard that for 3 years. So who is our advocate? I know when we were asked to contact Connect Maine, they said, sure, just go online and contact us. And that's kind of an impossibility.
Well, all right. Any thoughts about this? I know we're this is not your expertise, but yeah.
Well, I would just say, you know, I think one of the things that behind today's program is the commitment and the efforts Maine has made to create universal access. There's something to that in each of our programs, the fact that every community, regardless of economics or geography, the kids should have broadband access. They should have laptops. They should, in our case, we want them to be able to participate and acknowledge and be part with their own history. So we may not have gotten 100% coverage, unfortunately, and I think it's something we need to strive for. But I think an important part is we've had this commitment or this intention in Maine or this goal of including everybody. So clearly we just have to get that last mile.
All right. We're almost out of time, so I want to make sure we get the websites for each of you. Linda, go first.
We're at maine.gov/MSL/.
That's not too bad for a government. Steve?
Great. Well, our Maine Memory Network is very simple. It's www.mainmemory.net, and there's deep and extensive, really interesting material for I think that will interest just about anybody. So please go there. And just a reminder that Maine Memories Network is really made possible because of the Maine Historical Society. So if you visit our website, www.mainehistory.org, you'll get turned on to a lot of great resources related to Maine history.
And Betty, how do we find the Maine International Center for Digital Learning?
It's very easy. MICDL.org.
That is easy.
Yes.
Thank you. Oh, yes, Linda.
Maine public libraries are unlike schools in the state of Maine in that they don't receive any direct public support from the state. The majority of the states in our country do provide that direct public support, but all listeners today and all Maine citizens have an opportunity on their Maine income tax form to make a checkoff contribution to the Maine Public Library Fund. And a modest contribution of even $5 for many, many people, every penny of which has to go back to supporting Maine public libraries, would make an enormous difference in our capabilities.
All right. Thanks so much. Steve Bromwich, Executive Director of the Maine Historical Society. Betty Manchester of was with the Maine Learning Technology Initiative, now the Maine International Center for Digital Learning. And Linda Lord, State, Maine State Librarian. Thank you all. Today's program produced by Jonathan Smith. Volunteer Cindy Hahn answered your calls. John Keimel ran the board, and we had help from the MPBN web team. Tomorrow on the program, looking at the future of healthcare in Maine, I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.